Thousands of people are working to bring wildfires under control in our region at the moment. The weather of the last few days, as we pointed out, much cooler and wetter, has given at least the sense that a corner has been turned in this fire season. But think back a few months, and the wet winter had a lot of us thinking this summer would feature a mild fire season, and no such luck. This is not the only part of the world, of course, dealing with large fires. Fires are often bigger and more destructive all over the world. Michael Kotis lays out the issue through many individual stories in his book, Megafire, The Race to Extinguish a Deadly Epidemic of Flame. Michael Kotis is a reporter, photojournalist, and currently the deputy director of the Center for Environmental Journalism at the University of Colorado in Boulder. Michael, thanks for joining us today on The Exchange.
Thanks for having me on.
So let's focus on terminology first. When you say megafire, what do you mean?
Well, that's not a term with a very specific scientific definition. The U.S. Forest Service has come out to say that they define a megafire as any fire bigger than 100,000 acres. And when I started this project, I was really looking at the really big fires and their impacts. But came to kind of see a different definition of megafire in the idea that there are lots of smaller fires that behave differently than they have historically and consequently destroy a lot of houses or kill a lot of people or perhaps put a resource we're dependent on at risk or threaten our infrastructure, that are probably a lot more mega than a fire much bigger than 100,000 acres that's burning in a remote wilderness where fires like that have always burned and consequently isn't really putting that much of human infrastructure and human resources and human life at risk. So I really began to see megafires better measured by their impacts rather than their size.
All right, so it's not just acres alone. It's like how many houses they destroy or people they kill, and as you point out, there are quite a few of those cases in the book.
There are, yeah. We've seen a pretty huge increase in the destruction of property and in the loss of life in wildfires. I believe the most recent statistic shows a nearly five-fold increase in the number of homes burning in wildfires since the 1970s. And in that time, we've come close to doubling the number of wildland firefighters that die doing their job.
Wow, that is a lot. One of the things I'm most struck by, and you mentioned a moment ago, is fire behavior. It's almost as if people who have been around fire all their lives are reporting that fires just don't act like they used to.
Yeah, I focus a lot on the 2012 and 2013 fire seasons and went to dozens of fires during that period of time. And boy, I can't remember an incident commander stepping forward and not saying at one point that we're seeing fire behaviors we haven't seen before. Our forest structures have been changed by the way we manage our forests. We have a lot more people living in these forests, and that impacts wildfire. And the climate is driving fire behaviors that firefighters aren't used to. For instance, it used to be that wildfires would usually lay down a little bit at night because the temperature would drop and the humidity would rise, and that would bring some moisture into the fuels and tamp down the flames a bit so the firefighters could get a good start on their morning's firefighting. And very often now, those fires burn intensely right through the night because the temperatures aren't dropping enough now to raise the humidity enough to make those fuels slow down their burning.
We noticed something very much like that with the Chetco Bar fire, which is the closest large fire. It's actually within our listening area, and it burned within a couple of miles of the Pacific Ocean, partly because of the fact that, just like what you're talking about, the temperatures did not drop at night, the humidities did not rise as much as firefighters anticipated.
Yeah, it's happening, more and more commonly. Certainly out where you're at, you would expect, the ocean to have an impact on that. And I think that impact's been, mitigated some by the changing temperatures and the changing climate. And it's something we've seen a lot here in Colorado as well, where, very often in the high peaks here, the temperatures would drop quite a bit at night, and they're just not doing that as much. And we're also seeing what a lot of scientists and firefighters are referring to as the year-round fire season. Climate has very big impacts on how long our fire season burns. And throughout much of the West, snowpack on high peaks was a trickle reservoir that would keep forests moist and keep them from burning until the summer arrived. And with many of these mountains receiving less snow and that snow melting off much earlier in the year due to warmer temperatures, those forests are primed to burn much earlier in the year and often can burn much later in the year. In fact, one of the fires I write about was a fire in Rocky Mountain National Park, so one of our highest, most alpine, snowiest parks in the country, and that was a wildfire that ignited in October and burned right through the winter in, you know, this very snowy and cold national park.
Did it snow much that winter?
What happened was the fire had a major run in December, threatened a number of structures. They had to bring firefighters in who had been furloughed for the season. And that got enough fire on the ground and enough wood burning that when snow finally did come, the flames or the embers basically smoldered under the snow, so that when that snow melted off earlier than normal the next year, the fire reignited. And actually, that fire was not declared out until the following June.
Wow. I can't remember hearing about that one, but that's just amazing. It basically played possum through the winter and then came up again and got going again.
Yeah, you know, snow and the weather usually puts out our wildfires and many of our biggest and baddest fires. You know, we can try to herd them and maybe protect resources and structures, but it's really the weather that comes in and puts them out. And if the timing of that weather is different due to climate change, which it has been lately, then often those fires can survive that weather, you know, either burning under snow or, you know, smoldering, you know, when the fuels get moist and keeping those fuels dry.
Well, cautionary tale for our region. We've been talking about the season-ending event that the current cool spell might be giving us, but it might not be that after all, as we're hearing from Michael Kotis. His book is called Megafire, The Race to Extinguish a Deadly Epidemic of Flame. We'll come back and talk more with Michael and take phone calls and emails from you if you'd like to join us when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 10. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of JPR, Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest is Michael Kotis, a journalist, reporter, photojournalist, and deputy director of the Center for Environmental Journalism at the University of Colorado in Boulder. His book is called Megafire, The Race to Extinguish a Deadly Epidemic of Flame, quite timely given what's been going on around us for several months now. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about the change in fire behavior in general. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So, Michael, you cite four main drivers for the increasing incidence of big fires. What are those?
So I broke out the underlying science and economic drivers of wildfire into four categories. And so one would be forest management. And we put out every fire that we could in the United States for about a century. We actually had a policy back that started back in the 1930s called the Out by 10 a.m. policy, which was any natural wildfire would be extinguished by 10 a.m. the next day. And that ignores the work that fire does in many of our forests, because fire is as natural to our forests as rain, and many of our forests really need wildfire to be healthy. So, you know, if you go into a forest that normally has a fire in it every 10 or 20 years and you put out every fire for a century, it's not very difficult math to figure out that you're going to have 10 or 20 times more fuel in that forest than you naturally would. And you've really changed the structure of that forest, that you may end up with different species of trees and plants growing there that may be more flammable. But you're definitely going to have a much heavier fuel load, as firefighters call it. So that's one category. You know, another category, which we just discussed, is climate. You know, across the U.S., the estimate is that climate has expanded our wildfire seasons by around 2 months in most areas. And in a lot of places, like here in Colorado and in California, they're saying that we don't really have a fire season anymore. Our fire season is year-round. We have wildfires like we've never seen before burning in November and December and January. So, you know, climate is a very big driver of the increase in fire as well. A third category is the way that we develop and build into our woodlands. When we move homes into forested areas and mountainous areas, we add a new fuel load to those forests in the propane tanks that we have there and the fuel in our vehicles and the wood and materials that we build our houses off of. So that changes the fuel structure, but we also introduce a lot of sparks to those landscapes. One study this year at the University of Colorado showed that over a 20-year period, 84% of the wildfires were started by humans. So as soon as you put a road into a forest, you allow human access, you're going to get more campfires, more sparks from firearms, and so forth. And then as you develop in there, you'll have power lines that can start fires. You're going to have vehicles and their hot mufflers or sparks from their wheels can start fires. And you're going to both introduce a lot of new fuels into that forest, and you're going to have a lot more sparks to ignite fires in that forest. So that's the third driver. And then the fourth is really the politics and economics behind how we have dealt with wildfires. Wildfire has increased so much that there's a huge amount of money in firefighting and a huge amount of resource at risk. And that leads to a lot of decisions about dealing with wildfire that are not necessarily based on environmental concerns, ecological concerns, or practicalities of dealing with a natural hazard.
I noticed too that the discussions about forest management seem to have picked up this time long before any of the fires were out. I mean, I don't know if you saw the Facebook meme showing up with pictures of burning forests, and it said "Thanks Sierra Club," that kind of thing.
We politicize wildfire. Fire is such a core element of being human. A lot of anthropologists think that fire is what made us human, our alliance with fire to cook food and warm our homes and where we lived and drive back the night. We attach so much to fire that sometimes it's hard to sort through the realities of that. The criticisms of, say, the Sierra Club for protecting lands from logging and therefore allowing those forests to become thicker and thus more prone to burn may be true in a couple of forests, but obviously these forests survived for centuries with no logging in them, without seeing the kind of fire that we're seeing right now, or many of these forests had never seen the kind of fire that we're seeing right now. So it's unlikely that any environmental organization that, say, has protected a forest or a species from logging or impacts of human activity in that forest had a vast impact on forests across the country.
We're talking to Michael Kotis about his book, Megafire, The Race to Extinguish a Deadly Epidemic of Flame. We have an email here already from Bruce in Happy Camp, who says, as a builder, I have never had anyone want to try and build a fire-resistant house. I have always wanted to do a project where I could really concentrate on fireproofing a structure from the outside forest fires. In western Northern California and southern Oregon, we have been suppressing natural fires for up to 100 years. Even in wilderness areas, most lightning fires were jumped and put out. I see clear-cut forestry practices with its drying out and even aged, overstocked plantations as being the culprit, along with the suppression history for our area here. Would you agree or disagree? Asks Bruce in Happy Camp.
I agree with all of that. It's a mix of all of those drivers. The interesting thing that he brings up is the fact that, you know, it's very difficult to encourage the population that wants to live in the mountains and in forests to do everything that they should to protect their property and their lives.
And in fact, there's a great story in here about Tom and Sharon Scanlon building a fireproof home in Colorado, or so they thought it was fireproof.
Yeah, there's no guarantee, even if you do everything right, that you're going to be protected from the kinds of fires that we're seeing now, because they very often are behaving outside the boundaries of what firefighters have seen historically. But by and large, just because you choose to live in the woods or live in the mountains doesn't mean that you have to leave yourself vulnerable to a wildland fire disaster. You know, you can build your home with a metal roof and with materials that are less likely to catch fire from flames or embers, and you can keep your propane tank far away from your building or even bury it. You know, things like that. One of the challenges that has developed around building in these homes is, or building in these areas, building homes in flammable forests, is a lot of people kind of see preparing their property for wildfire as surgery. In other words, if they go out one time and cut down some trees and some branches off of some other trees, and move a few things around, one time will fix it, and then they're set for the wildfire threat forever. And the reality is that dealing with wildfires is a lot more like a medication that you need to take every day for a chronic illness. You need to be out there cleaning the needles off of your deck and cleaning out your gutters every week. You need to be going out and looking at all of the insidious little flammable materials that build up around your home if you live in the forest, and making sure that you're getting that stuff out of the way so that when a fire does burn in your forest, and every forest in this country is going to burn at one time or another, you have already removed a lot of the little materials and done a lot of the little things that will make your home less likely to be vulnerable to that fire.
So constant maintenance is what is called for, not just the one-time clearing out of defensible space around the house.
Correct. And that one-time clearing out defensible space is really important, too. You just have to keep following that up.
Michael Kotas, again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is called Megafire, The Race to Extinguish a Deadly Epidemic of Flame. You can join the conversation on the Jefferson Exchange by phone, 800-838-3760, as we talk about wildfires and how big and ugly they've gotten. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Here's a phone call from John in Veneta. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Michael Kotas.
Good morning, Mike. Good morning, Jeff.
Hi.
Yeah, I usually try to bring this up whenever I get a chance. I might have missed what you said because I was working earlier. I didn't hear the first part of this, but the management, force management part of this. I'm an old hell attacker, initial attack wildfire fighter, and I've watched this for a long time, and I'm not really young, so I've gotten some years behind looking at it, and I've lived and hunted in the woods. And I've watched what went on with the reprod, and they go in and they'll plant. Now, they put some rules down for the planting period, like a two-year thing or whatever. But there is so many dog-hair-thick patches that they've just ignored. They've got the money and they've run, as the old saying went in the old days, like they did back in Minnesota, Wisconsin. And that's just wrong, because when that stuff burns, you just get out of the way because it just blows up. And the trees get sick. They start blistering because they're stunted because they haven't been thinned. And that's one thing. And then the other thing is, a few years back, I went for a plane ride with my brother-in-law, and we were between Black Butte and Bend. You can look down and you can see all this what I'll just call real estate, because they've taken this basically a wild land. It's tumbleweed, sagebrush, junipers, and they put the houses just far enough apart so they can't quite see each other. And these people can move in there and feel like they're out in the woods. And every one of them's got at least one barbecue behind them, and as far as I'm concerned, we've been living on borrowed time with both these subjects.
All right. Thanks for that, John. Appreciate that. Your thoughts, Michael, on reforestation and building?
Yeah. So, when you talk about forest management, you absolutely have to include what we plant in our forests. And that has definitely been a problem in the U.S. It's been a much greater problem in some other countries where I've reported on wildfire. Some of your listeners may recall a horrible fire a couple of months ago in Portugal, which killed about 64 people, most of them in their cars as they were trying to evacuate. And that was in a forest of planted eucalyptus Portuguese forestry companies had planted for the paper, paper and pulp business. In Israel, which is not a country we think of as having a wildfire problem, has its worst natural disaster in history was a wildfire, and nearly 70% of the forests in Israel are planted. And, you know, these forests, many of them were planted many decades ago, and now that they've matured, they have, you know, these giant monoculture pine forests in a desert. And obviously that's a recipe for conflagration. So, you know, that's one aspect. The other aspect of development is definitely a very complex topic, but a really important one for us to deal with. When we build these developments into mountainous areas and into forests, we create a lot of safety problems for the people who live there. And I live in Colorado, and lots of people move to the forest here, and we move because we want to be near the trees. But very often, we're moving into a forest that looks nothing like it did a century ago. It's not a particularly healthy or natural forest, but as one forester mentioned to me when I was starting work on this project, boy, if you're younger than 50 years old, it's pretty unlikely you've seen a natural ponderosa pine forest in this country. We've changed the structure so much. And so these folks are moving into often much more flammable forests than they were historically, and into developments that have some other safety hazards, for instance, egress. There are winding, narrow roads to many of these homes and developments that would be very difficult to get a fire truck or firefighters up and are very difficult to run an evacuation on. And so, again, I'm not here to say that people shouldn't be allowed to live in the mountains or in the forests, but they should be very aware of the nature of the forest that they're living in and the nature of the hazard around them. When the fire is ignited, it's far too late to be considering whether you're going to be able to get in or out of your property safely, or whether your property is appropriately prepared for, you know, a fire that would threaten it.
Michael Kotis, our guest on The Exchange. His book is Megafire, The Race to Extinguish a Deadly Epidemic of Flame. We've been talking in terms of forests, but we need to hasten to add it's not just forests. You have a whole story in here about the Hartstrong Fire and the Struckmeyer family.
Yeah, and that was actually a really important story for me to tell personally, because one thing, you know, in all of our coverage of big forest fires is we very often see photos and coverage of our forest firefighters who are working for the Forest Service or the Bureau of Land Management or the Park Service, you know, in their green pants and yellow shirts, and they definitely do hard work, but about half of the firefighters in Colorado, and I think the figure nationally is even higher, are volunteers in volunteer fire departments that don't get special training to fight wildfires and often don't have any of the equipment that we see on the big fires. But they're often the first responders to a wildfire, is a volunteer department. And this was a volunteer department where nearly half of the members of the department were from one family that had started the department out on the plains in Colorado in the agricultural land that we have. And, ended up getting burned over in a wildfire in grasslands, because grasslands actually have a fire cycle too, and they're seeing a huge increase of very dangerous wildfires as well. Grass is what they call a flashy fuel. In other words, it burns really quickly, and a grass fire can move much faster, can cover miles of the plains, in a matter of hours. And so they're incredibly dangerous for firefighters to deal with, particularly when those firefighters are volunteers with day jobs and trying to figure out how they can free themselves up and get out and help.
You worked as a firefighter yourself for a time, is that right?
I worked for a firefighter over a summer when I was first covering wildfire. That's been quite a number of years ago. And, one thing that interested me in writing this book was talking to folks that I knew who were still dealing with wildfire, who told me that, you know, boy, things are really different from when you were doing this. You know, things have really changed. The fires are bigger, they're hotter, they're faster, it's more dangerous, and we're increasingly seeing wildland firefighters having to deal with the challenges that are structure firefighters' purview. A wildland firefighter you know, as I mentioned, you know, we have a lot of volunteers that are, you know, set up to fight structure fires. Wildland firefighters, on the other hand, are not prepared to deal with structure fires. They don't have the heavy bunker gear that they wear to protect them from, you know, falling material in a house and so forth. They don't have the oxygen masks and oxygen tanks. But increasingly, as wildfires deal with wildfires threaten developments in woodlands or burn over communities, wildland firefighters are trying to go in and help out in situations where homes are getting burned. One illustration of this to me was I re-upped my red card, which is the certification that you have with the federal government to fight wildfires. And I did that maybe 2 or 3 years ago as I was working on this book. And in the training, there were a lot of topics that I had never heard about when I was doing fire before. For instance, one test section dealt with what do you do if you run into a meth lab while you're fighting a fire in a forest, or how do you deal with a long driveway that goes to a home. And those were really illustrations of how wildland firefighters are increasingly having to deal with what humans have done to the forest or built into the forest, and often are neither equipped for nor trained to deal with.
I've heard that concern before, that they're not trained for fighting structure fires. It's a very different kind of firefighting altogether. I did pull up some statistics from the National Interagency Fire Center. These are year-to-date statistics from January 1st to yesterday, the 19th of September. And this year in the United States, 8,530,000-plus acres had burned. That's not quite double what last year's number was by this point, which was 4,827,000 and change. The record was just the year before that, though, up to the date, because it had burned 8.8 million on its way to a year record for 10.1 million acres of fires burned. So, yes, a lot of acres of fires burn in fires across this country. We'll get back to Michael Kotis and Megafire here on the Jefferson Exchange with your phone calls and emails in a minute 10. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest is Michael Kotis, who is the Deputy Director of the Center for Environmental Journalism at the University of Colorado in Boulder. He is himself a reporter and a photojournalist and the author of one other book. His latest one is called Megafire, The Race to Extinguish a Deadly Epidemic of Flame. It explores all the reasons that fires have gotten so big and so nasty and so destructive all over the world. You can join the conversation on the exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. I want to come back to something you said in passing earlier and underscore just a little bit, Michael, about sociologists and our relationship with fire and the fact that it's just possible that these big brains we have are a result of fire.
Yeah, that's really some fascinating research that's been done over the last several years by a number of different scientists. But, you know, when we were somehow got the idea that we could heat up food and heat up meat, heat up vegetables, we released lots of calories out of that food that were unavailable to other animals if they weren't cooking that food. And that meant we had a lot, we spent a lot less time having to gather and chew food than other animals did. It also led to us having a much bigger brain than basically, you know, any other primate. And it also allowed our guts to get a lot smaller because digestion became a lot easier for us when we cooked food. So we ended up with smaller guts, bigger brains, and a lot more time on our hands. And a lot of scientists feel as though that gave us, you know, our biggest evolutionary advantage over other species.
So from millions of years ago to a little more recently, I want to talk about Big Ed Pulaski. He invented one of the tools that firefighters use even today. He was in a gigantic fire in 1910. So there were earlier megafires. What's the difference now?
Well, you know, I think the reality is if we go back and look at foresters and study their study of our forests, we probably had a number of years where we had much more acreage burning than even what we're seeing today. When we look at the records that we're setting now, we need to keep in mind that we haven't been keeping those records in the time frame that, say, a forest thinks. You know, these aren't records from thousands of years. These are records from, a little bit less than a century. But, Big Ed Pulaski was a ranger who was fighting a fire we call the Big Burn in the Bitterroot Mountains in Montana and Idaho. And he has just this amazing story, one of the really great creation myth stories of the West, where he had a crew of more than 40 wildland firefighters who were with him, and we're being quite generous to call most of those men wildland firefighters. Back then, any guy who could swing an axe could be a wildland firefighter with no training. And when the fire got bad, they were running into bars and running into transient camps and anywhere they could find guys that had the physical wherewithal to hike into the woods and swing an axe or dig with a shovel. You were a wildland firefighter. And Ed Pulaski had about 40 of these guys, and they were about to be overrun by a fire that was destroying the town of Wallace, Idaho, and doing great damage to many other towns. It was about the size of Connecticut. And according to Pulaski, it roared in a way that sounded like 1,500 trains on 1,500 trestles. And he saw only one chance for his crew to survive, and he knew of a mining adit, a little mine shaft in the mountains, and he led his crew to this mine shaft and got them all to get inside this tiny little space, and the firefighters got in there, the oxygen got sucked out, it started filling with smoke, and they freaked out and tried to bolt from the mine shaft, and Ed Pulaski pulled his gun and held them in the mine shaft at gunpoint. Eventually, they all passed out. The horses that were with them, most of them died. Three of the firefighters died, but most of them lived. And when they came to, they found Ed Pulaski laying at the front of the mine shaft, and one of the firefighters he'd recruited said, "Hey, guys, the boss is dead." And Pulaski raised his head and said, "Like hell he is." And, just a great story. Pulaski was horribly injured, and but kept his work going on the fire line and saw that the tools for wildland firefighting weren't what he thought were the best for the kind of work they were doing. So he welded a hoe to an axe and invented this tool we call the Pulaski. It's now the most common tool on the fire line in the United States. So even firefighters that don't know his name shout out his name on the fire line every year.
Yeah, get rid of the Pulaski.
Fascinating. But the legacy of the Big Burn loomed a lot larger in how we dealt with wildfire after this. The Forest Service at that point was just about 5 years old. It was hated in much of the West because, here was a federal agency that had come to impose order on forests that up to that point had been basically a free-for-all. And so they were not a very popular organization. And the Big Burn kind of became this creation myth for the Forest Service. The next five directors of the Forest Service were veterans of the Big Burn, and they saw, rather than the complete failure of firefighting on the Big Burn, which is what the firefighters who were actually on the front lines said it was, they saw this as an opportunity to grow their organization. They effectively declared war on wildfire. And by the 1930s, the last of the veterans of the Big Burn to lead the Forest Service implemented what we called the out by 10 a.m. policy, which was that any natural fire in the country would be extinguished by 10 a.m. the next day. So there was this attitude that wildfire wasn't, as many people see it, a weather phenomenon. It was more like a species that we could eradicate from our forests if we just worked hard enough. And so we took on this task of putting together an army of firefighters every year to go and extinguish every fire that they could. And that, of course, a century later, has led to a lot of the problems that we see today in our forests. You know, not all of our forests are showing worse fires because of excess suppression, but many ponderosa pine forests, particularly in the Southwest, in Arizona, in New Mexico, here in Colorado, do show a pretty radical increase in the severity of wildfires due to all the fires that we extinguished in the past.
Yeah, some of those tree densities per acre that you listed in Arizona in the book were just shocking. I mean, they were usually 10 trees per acre traditionally, and they were about 400 or something.
Yeah, in some cases we're seeing, a 20-fold increase in the density of some of these forests. In some cases, getting back to your previous caller, not only did they extinguish every fire and allow the forest to grow very dense, but they also planted in them. They would create tree plantations, and if the industry that they were planting these trees to fuel didn't take off, then all those trees that they planted just contributed to that increased density of the forest.
Let's take some calls. Jess in Medford, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Michael Kotas, the author of Megafire. Jess, you there?
Yes, I am. Yeah, good morning, Michael and Jeff.
Hi.
I spent many, many hours swinging a Pulaski and on fire lines and stuff. I worked for the BLM, and before that I worked for private contractors and whatnot. But anyway, it seems like forest managers are up against a real dilemma when it comes to, there was a policy they were talking about just about the time I got out of firefighting, and was let burn in remote areas. You know, if you have a lightning strike in the middle of a big wilderness area, just let it go. And in 2002, I think they kind of did that on the Flounce Rock and the Biscuit Rock fire, and all of a sudden it blew up. They had a 500,000 acre fire, and it's a good idea, you know, if you have wild country, hey, the fire burn like it's supposed to. And yet if you're a forest manager, you're thinking about, well, what the heck happens if this thing goes in the wrong direction or wind kicks up and it goes into some town or into some neighborhood or something like that. It strikes me that there's just a lot of very difficult decisions that wildland firefighting managers have to make.
Indeed. Thanks for the call, Jess. And let's get a response from Michael.
Yeah. So there is, a push by many foresters and firefighters to let some of our fires burn. You know, if it's a fire that's burning much as fires in that area have always burned, and it's a remote area and there's not a lot of homes at risk or infrastructure that we depend on at risk, you know, maybe we can let that fire burn and do the good work for that forest that fires usually do. Many of our animal species even are dependent on wildfire to create habitat for them. But that's a huge risk. About 40 years ago, Starker Leopold, who was the great naturalist Aldo Leopold's son, wrote a report for the Park Service that talked about reintroducing wildfire to our unhealthy forests that were unhealthy due to all of the fires that we'd put out in the past. But that is a very difficult and dangerous proposition, as your caller notes. Sometimes it comes off really well. Sometimes we have a fire that we let burn that turns into a big conflagration that's very, very difficult to deal with. You know, one of the ironies of wildfire is the cheapest way to deal with them is to put them out fast. But, of course, eventually you're going to have a fire that you won't be able to put out fast, and it's going to burn much worse than it would have if you hadn't put out those previous fires. That's a complication. The other thing that we do is prescribed burns, where foresters and firefighters go in and intentionally set a wildfire in an area to have a fire go through that area in a time of year and in conditions where they think they can manage it. That also has proven to be very, very, very dangerous. One fire I write about in my book, in 2012 here in Colorado, was a Colorado state prescribed burn that was intended to bring a watershed back to health that the city of Denver depends on for its water supply. And that prescribed burn reignited several days after they thought it was out. And this was in the first days of spring when we normally would have a lot of snow on the ground, but it was actually very dry. And when that fire reignited, it quickly burned into a nearby neighborhood and destroyed more than 20 of the homes in the neighborhood and killed three of the residents there. And that, of course, builds a lot of resistance to prescribed burns and allowing fires to burn. Back in 2000, outside of Los Alamos, New Mexico, a prescribed burn got away like that and burned hundreds of homes in the town of Los Alamos and actually burned onto the grounds of the nuclear laboratory. And that, at the time, was the most expensive wildfire in the history of the country. So that kind of shows you the extreme ends of that. Bringing this forest back to health requires us to have some fire get back into it, but if things go wrong, it can turn into a very, very bad wildfire. And so land managers are kind of painted into a corner with that. One positive development that's kind of come out of the last few years in forest management and fire management is the idea that we can manage fires for multiple objectives. So we can have a fire that on one flank isn't threatening very much and is probably going to do some good work in a more remote forest, and we can let that flank go and let that fire just burn in whatever direction it's going in, so long as it doesn't put anything at risk, and let that fire burn. But on another flank of the very same fire that might risk a community or threaten a community or threaten a watershed or something like that, we can work really hard to suppress the fire on that flank. And so this idea that every fire doesn't have to be either a let-it-burn fire or a full suppression fire, we can treat different parts of a fire in different ways.
Do you think, Michael, there's a big market or a big an audience anyway for the discussion of large-scale thinning projects? I mean, we have the Ashland Forest Resiliency Stewardship Project in the watershed above Ashland, where we have our broadcasting base. And so they've done a lot of work to clear out the underbrush and bring some controlled burn in there, but it has been very intensive, very labor-intensive, and has required the removal of some merchantable trees and things like that.
Yeah, so I do think that can be helpful, particularly near communities, and near homes. But the reality is, both the federal government and the states, which also have, that are forested lands that they need to deal with, never come close to thinning or having prescribed burns on the land to meeting their goals, to having as many of those as they need to have. We are really only able to treat a fraction of the land that needs treating. So that's helpful, but it's not going to solve the problem. And of course, there's, depending on the community you're in, can be great resistance to either a prescribed burn because people don't want smoke in the air or a fire in the forest near their homes at all. And there can be a lot of resistance to thinning projects too. A lot of people see them as fronts for logging operations or think that they're going to change the forest in a way that they aren't going to enjoy anymore.
I want to thank all the listeners who called. They called kind of late in the program, though, so we couldn't get them all in. My apologies there. We do want to thank Michael Kotis for joining us today to talk about megafire, the race to extinguish a deadly epidemic of flame. Mike, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me on. I really enjoyed it.